for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. It's the second day of Senate confirmation hearings for Loretta Lynch, President Obama's choice for Attorney General. Yesterday, members of the Judiciary Committee questioned her views on Justice Department responsibilities and the limits of executive power. Joining me to talk about the hearings and prospects for her confirmation, Del Quentin Wilbur of Bloomberg News, Jeff Mason of Reuters, joining us by phone from Virginia, Bruce Fine, an attorney specializing in constitutional and international law, and by phone from Park City, Utah, Robert Rabin. He's former assistant attorney general for legislative affairs. I do hope you'll join the conversation. Give us a call at 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. And thank you all for being with us.
Great to be with you.
Great to be with you.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you.
Nice to have you all with us. Del Wilbur, you were there at the hearings yesterday. How'd they go? Give us your impression.
You know, it was very interesting. It was a very polite hearing. Dana Milbank had a funny line, the Washington Post writer today, that she had them at Jim Crow. And so she came out and gave this wonderful biography of herself, her life story, growing up in North Carolina, the daughter of a a Baptist preacher, a librarian. She gave this, you know, how she overcame some, like, you know, discrimination growing up. She went to Harvard Law School, was a U.S. attorney. And that kind of boxed them in, the Republicans. And it was one of the more polite confirmation hearings probably of the Obama era. Like, they were tough on her. They asked her tough questions. But, like, even when she and Ted Cruz got into it on a certain point about Nixon's Attorney General Mitchell and whether he should have been investigating Nixon during Watergate, and it got very complicated, it was like almost like, you know, they were very polite to each other. So it went very well for her. I think that she picked up some Republican votes, actually.
Jeff Mason, what was your impression?
I think I would agree with Del that she really had them well in hand. And the fact, some of the racial overtones, just of the fact that the committee was entirely white, and this would be the first African-American woman attorney general. She had a lot of supporters in the room from her sorority, wearing red, her father. And so that was quite interesting as well. I think that alone made it, and that aside, her qualifications are so robust. It was difficult for Republicans to really get any shots in because of her qualifications and because of her background.
It would seem that the current attorney general was more the subject of the hearings than Loretta Lynch herself.
Absolutely, which was fascinating. And she was asked that, will you be Eric Holder? And she said, no. I will not. If I'm confirmed to be Attorney General, I will be Loretta Lynch. And that, the ghost of Eric Holder, or the presence of Eric Holder, absolutely hung over those hearings all day long.
Robert Rabin, you are someone not only familiar with this entire process, you've worked on Loretta Lynch's nomination in particular. Explain your role.
Thank you very much, and thanks so much for having me, Diane. I, since I left the Department of Justice, I have made myself available to nominees, Republicans and Democrats, who need to go through what is kind of an inscrutable and sometimes bizarre process. And so I've just been honored to help a bunch of nominees, including Attorney Lynch.
What do you see as her strengths?
Wow. How much time do you have? it's interesting. I worked with her in the Clinton administration and have maintained contact with her over the last 15 years. She's a powerful, tough, fair, smart, experienced prosecutor. She deeply, deeply loves the law. She's experienced with law enforcement, and she's cognizant and interested in civil rights. So it's hard to imagine a better pick by President Obama for this role.
And Bruce Fine, what's your take?
Well, I was disappointed because despite all of the personal accolades that she richly deserves, right now the crisis of the Constitution is limitless executive power, especially in the national security area. the authority the president claims to go to war unilaterally. We've been fighting a war against, you know, Islamic State and Syria for 5 or 6 months. There's no congressional authorization, even not a specific appropriations to have funds to conduct warfare there. For what particular purpose, no one knows about. And that's not the only instance. Look where we are in Libya, a unilateral presidential war, you know, that sent the signal to Iran and North Korea, if you get rid of WMD like Colonel Gaddafi, we invade, we overthrow you. It's so chaotic now. We have the Islamic State in Libya. It's what happens when you have unilateral presidential wars without scrutiny, and that wasn't a topic that was raised.
But tell me what her answer was on President Obama's use of an executive order for, say, immigration reform.
Well, immigration, she just basically said, I read the memoranda, and I have as well. I didn't find them persuasive. In fact, I drafted legislation for Congressman Yoho that passed the last Congress saying you just can't unilaterally suspend the enforcement of laws on a categorical basis. That's not case-by-case prosecutorial discretion. It's simply suspending the law the same way that the British Parliament decided the king shouldn't do that anymore after 1688.
She differ with President Obama on the issue of legalizing marijuana.
Yes, but that's a question of whether or not it makes any sense, Diane, as a matter of policy. It wasn't a question of constitutional magnitude. And my major worry is we need an attorney general like an Elliot Richardson who says, you know, the president goes too far, I'm quitting. We don't need someone like Francis Biddle, who had all the accolades and more of Loretta Lynch as attorney general and knew that the concentration camps for Japanese Americans in World War II were wrong. And he just said, well, so I'll go along with it. You know, that wasn't right then. It was repudiated later.
Robert Rabin, you want to get in.
Yeah, thank you so much. And Bruce is a national treasure, and he has been making this point for, I won't say your age, but at least 30 years, and he's absolutely right, and he ought to be delighted with Loretta Lynch. She said repeatedly during the hearing that she would have no compunction and no inhibition about saying no to the president. So, case closed.
But this is one of the things that, to my mind, Robert, is a little bit puzzling. She kept saying correctly, you know, she's not Eric Holder. Well, if she's not, you know, Eric Holder is the one who sat by and authorized all these sorts of things. And I didn't hear her suggest that any of these, what I consider extravagant claims of executive authority, that not only the war issue, but the authority to kill any American citizen that in secret the president decides is an imminent danger, is at all beyond his constitutional authority.
Dale Wilbur.
Yeah.
No, I think she handled these questions in a very confident manner yesterday as she was addressing them. She definitely could not dodge the immigration question that you brought up, Diane. I mean, she has to toe that line if she's going to be his nominee. She said, I think that it was reasonable, the legal analysis behind it. So she backs that. But then every other question, except for like a few personal ones, like, do you believe in the death penalty? She said, I think it's effective. They asked her a question about NSA surveillance program. She said, I think it's constitutional and effective. But other than that, like when they tried to get her to kind of tie herself to Eric Holder, as we've talked about earlier, Eric Holder was the ghost. He was the apparition. He was there at this hearing, right? He was like a presence. He was sitting next to her, you know? And every time they tried to tie her to him, she's like, I don't know about that. I haven't been briefed. I haven't read it. And then she pivoted and like trying to like, you know, the relationship between Holder and Congress, particularly Republicans, has been toxic. Completely toxic. He was the first sitting cabinet official held in contempt by the House of Representatives. And every answer, I did this multiple choice yesterday. I said, all right, this was her answer. I look forward to, quotes, A, meeting with you, B, discussing this further with you, C, consulting with you, and D, hearing your concerns.
All of the above.
Or E, all of the above.
Yeah.
Every question.
How about that?
I think it's important to emphasize the issue of immigration that you brought up. It would be completely unreasonable to think that the president would nominate an attorney general who did not think that his executive action was constitutional or reasonable. And she said that. I mean, she quite rightly said that she would be independent of the president. But you're not. I mean, the Republicans wanted to make some political points yesterday, and they're especially upset about the issue of the immigration executive order. But they weren't going to make any mileage with Loretta Lynch on that particular issue.
Robert Rabin, how well prepared was she to deal with questions in regard to Eric Holder and as Dell has said, simply check all of the above.
Thank you. I think the deepest preparation one could possibly have, she's had 30 years of excellent lawyering in the corporate sector. She's been on boards, and she was twice confirmed by the Senate to be the United States Attorney in one of the most complicated districts in the United States, the Eastern District of New York, Brooklyn. So she's been in court dozens and dozens and dozens of times. She's taken down gangs. She's taken down corporations. She's taken down cop killers. She's implemented the death penalty. I think that was the preparation.
I think if I could volunteer, Diane, there was one specific that
Bruce, make it quick.
Yes.
We're about to go to a break.
She said waterboarding is torture. Well, and the Senate Intelligence Committee report says there are a lot of people still working in the United States government who are complicit in the torture. Well, if it is, what's she going to do about it?
All right, and that is the voice of Bruce Fine. He is a constitutional lawyer and the author of Constitutional Peril. Short break, right back.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumosity.com. Brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com. From Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. And from Joyce V. Hale, seeking a world challenged and invigorated through a deeper understanding of ideas.
Welcome back. The congressional hearings on the new attorney general nominated by President Obama, Loretta Lynch, are ongoing. We have four guests with us to discuss her pluses and minuses. Bruce Fine is principal of Bruce Fine and Associates. Robert Rabin is president and founder of the Rabin Group, former assistant attorney general for legislative affairs. Dale Wilbur is justice correspondent for Bloomberg News. Jeff Mason is White House correspondent for Reuters. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Here's an email from Karen, who says, it is somewhat perplexing. Republicans cannot stand Eric Holder. Their questioning so far has not really been targeting Ms. Lynch, but Eric Holder. It appears she will be confirmed eventually, and Holder will stay in office until the confirmation. I would think Republicans would want it sooner rather than later, given their feelings toward the Attorney General. What do you think about that, Bruce Fine?
Well, I think that's a very insightful observation. Why since it's a suggestion it wouldn't be till March or something, till there's a final vote, would you defer installing an attorney general that you have nothing but accolades for and permit an attorney general who you have at least, some sense of antagonism towards to remain and making these important decisions? Because, as we talk now, there are still very, very critical legal issues outstanding with regard to the, continuing
Indeed.
War and various and sundry other things.
So, all right. And Dill Wilbur, you've written a fair amount about Loretta Lynch. You've looked at her speeches. Give us some insight.
Well, just on the last question, they love to hate Eric Holder. Uh-huh. So they're in no rush to get rid of him. They it's like they're a nice little foil
there.
Oh, I see. Some
yep.
psychological drama on the Republican side. No, I did. I did a story for Bloomberg News where I went and read every single word that she has written that she provided to the Judiciary Committee. About 693 pages. And what was interesting to me is as they track through her career, federal prosecutors, I've covered law enforcement for a long time, they're a staid bunch. They wear suits. They don't stray across the line. Their lives are regimented by rules. You can't talk about this. You can talk about this. You can't talk about that. That's what their lives are like. And you can tell as she goes on in her career through these speeches that she gets more and more regimented as she goes along, like more and more less fiery. But in her early speeches, 1993, 1994, there are a couple speeches to church groups. And this is right after the L.A. riots. This is 1992, actually, right after the L.A. riots. And she's addressing a church group. And you can just see the passion in her words for racial justice, for social equality, things that really along the lines of Obama when he was in that period of his life and in Eric Holder. She said, our country is morally lost back then. She said, L.A. is burning. Atlanta is burning. Greenville, South Carolina is burning. It's burning because we have let all these problems in the inner cities, these minority communities, fester while we spent billions on the Gulf War. It was really fascinating.
And then she spent time in Rwanda.
She did. I did another story about her tenure in Rwanda. She volunteered between being the first time she was U.S. attorney at the end of 2001 and 2010 when she took over again for her second stint. She spent about 4 or 5 years training prosecutors at the International War Crimes Tribunal for Rwanda. They're at 1994 genocide, nearly 1 million people were killed. And her job was to help train prosecutors to do that. 2005, she gets brought back to prosecute not a war criminal, but a witness who lied to an appeals court recanting his testimony. And she spent a month, or about 30 days total, in Rwanda, in the hills of Rwanda, in a stuffy van, as witness after witness after witness, all bearing the scars, literally physical scars of genocide. Hatchets, machete hacks on them, missing limbs, and the emotional scars, eliciting their stories. And the people who are with her said, this really gave her an appreciation and reaffirmed her belief in international justice systems, while also giving an appreciation for the rule of law that even in the smallest case can make a difference.
It sort of lends even more to an already very compelling narrative about Loretta Lynch. And from the White House's perspective, I think that contributes more to her rock star quality that sort of came out at that hearing yesterday. And the truth is, the White House could use a rock star right now.
You said earlier during the break that Loretta Lynch was not the president's first choice.
That's right, and that makes the whole story sort of more interesting right now. His first choice was his former White House counsel, Kathy Rumler, and she was very controversial with Republicans and took her name out of the running when the president was still mulling over who to put up. So Lynch was not at the top of that list, but she has turned out to be a very positive choice for this White House at a time when relations between the executive branch and the legislature are not particularly strong, when the president has given his State of the Union address last week and has a budget coming out next week, with lots of programs that aren't especially popular with Republicans. And here you had hearings where Republicans were trying to score points, but overall were supportive, or at least there appears to be enough support that she will get out of that committee.
Robert Rabin, do you think that these hearings might end sooner than has been forecast?
Well, the hearings won't end sooner. There's a parade of people today coming who don't know her at all, who will repeat their concerns with the Obama administration and Eric Holder. It will have almost nothing to do with Loretta Lynch. I think rock star is the right word. She's got the national security chops. She's got the prosecution chops. I think to the probably chagrin of some of the conservatives, she's been endorsed by William Bratton and Louis Free and Rudy Giuliani. I think we're going to see her confirmed. It's a question of how quickly.
Who's fine? Do you agree?
I think that she will be confirmed, but I do think it's notable that all these things that she's done to show she's a trailblazer, she has a searing sense of justice, may come back to haunt her, because what is she going to do about the credible claims of torture that are in the Intelligence Committee report that has been released, at least the executive? Many claim that the United States war against Iraq was a violation of international law. The current bombing of Syria is a violation of international law. What's she going to do with regard to those who may be hauled before the International Criminal Court? What about those who have been attempting to sue because they are citizens or family members of citizens like Mr. Alaki, who without due process were disappeared, and his son? And the state secrets privilege is repeatedly invoked by the Justice Department to block any judicial inquiry into whether there ought to be redress for these killings of civilians. Is she going to walk away? Anyway, those are very critical issues.
Sure.
To show what her position is.
She's going to do, Bruce, those are the perfect questions, and they'd be the perfect questions for any nominee for a variety of positions at the Department of Justice. She's going to do exactly what she said she's going to do, which once she's there and confirmed, she's going to take a careful look at the facts and the law. She's going to apply the facts to the law, and she's going to render her judgment. You know, Bruce is an expert in the following, and it's why I love the law and him. We really have a majestic system in our country. We have three branches of government, and they work cooperatively to figure out what the Constitution is. So the Department of Justice and the White House opine, and then people challenge those opinions, and they go to federal court. And then judges make a determination of what's constitutional and not. And then we all gloriously follow that system. So the notion that there's some kind of imperial power in a presidency or at the Department of Justice is sort of a fiction that comes sometimes from the right, sometimes from the left, but it's a fiction nonetheless.
I can't let that go unanswered. That's a very powerful observation, and I agree with much, but not all. Let me give you a current example. The court has created all sorts of barriers to getting certain issues litigated. I'm working now with Congressman Walter Jones and others to see whether we can get standing to challenge the constitutionality of the war against Islamic State in Syria and perhaps soon Yemen without any authorization. It's enormously difficult. You've gone 10, 12 years, and there's no opinion.
You're absolutely right, Bruce. The Republican-dominated court has put barriers to entry. I invite you to come over to the Democratic side so we can fix this system.
All right. Anyway, that you acknowledge then that's a gap in the theory, that the courts do not always opine on these issues, and they are ultimately decided by sometimes unilaterally by the executive branch because Congress surrenders them.
All right. So I'm going to open the phones now and welcome our listeners. Let's go first to Barbara in Atlantic Beach, Florida. You're on the air.
Thank you, Diane, for having such a timely topic. I watched most of this yesterday, and I was really embarrassed for men that are probably younger than she, but just were so intent on cutting her up in little pieces because she happened to be President Obama's select person. It reminded me a great deal of behavior that I've noted when Hillary Clinton would come back from her country, you know, her movement to all these countries, and would be probably on a red eye all night and then hit this group in the morning, and the same kind of responses from these men. I felt like yesterday it was a pleasant surprise toward the end of this when some of the older members of that group apologized to her for the behavior of their their political mates in that group. I was just so, I think she sounds wonderful, but I was embarrassed.
Thanks for calling. I wonder, Jeff Mason, is there a risk that, in fact, Republicans who may sort of come after her and continue to come after her in the name of Eric Holder are going to suffer the kind of backlash they're going to hear from Barbara?
Sure. I think there's absolutely a risk. And I think it's something that, you know, they probably have a lot of confidence right now. This is the first time that the Republicans have controlled both houses of Congress, and that gives justifiable confidence. But this is an issue that have so many overtones. You've got political overtones, you've got racial overtones, you've got gender overtones, which the caller just referenced. All of that is important, and all of those are things that voters are watching. And you've got another election coming up in less than 2 years with potentially the first female candidate for a major party if Hillary Clinton runs and wins the Democratic nomination. All of these things are on tape. All of these things can be played again. So, yeah, of course there are risks.
Dale, did you feel some of that as well?
I did. What I think is going to be really interesting is seeing how her former home state senators in North Carolina will vote. I mean, they're both Republicans, and I wonder how they'll be boxed in by this great narrative that she has with, you know, a sizable population of people in North Carolina who would generally support her. I mean, that state, Obama won it in 2008, but he lost it in 2012, I believe, right? Very close. And so I don't know. I don't think it would play very well for them to vote against it. It's gonna be fascinating to see how the politics of the Republican side fall out on this. It's gonna be fascinating. It's much more interesting in many ways as a kind of a spectator than if he had nominated Rumler. Because I would still be there at the hearing. It wouldn't have ended, and I wouldn't be on your show right now. That's how contentious it would have been. But, like, I think it's a really interesting. It's going to be fun to see.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Mark in Dallas, Texas. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I have to admit that I'm sort of baffled that there would be, the immigration issue aside, any resistance to Ms. Lynch's confirmation whatsoever. If you look at her positions, she is fine with war by executive fiat, assassination by drone. She thinks mass NSA warrantless wiretapping is both constitutional and effective. She disagrees with the president on the scientific fact that marijuana is less harmful than alcohol. So it seems to me that she's well within the mainstream, although she's apparently completely disconnected from what public sentiment is. She's well within the mainstream of both the Democratic and Republican parties.
Jeff Mace.
And I think that also raises the interesting question, if she is confirmed, about how big the difference is between a Justice Department run by Loretta Lynch and Barack Obama's White House might be. The last 6 years, the president has had a very close friend in the Justice Department. In fact, many people think that's why Eric Holder has lasted as long as he has, despite some major stumbles. They're tight. Their wives are tight. And this will be different. This is someone, as we already said, it wasn't his first choice. They're not particularly close. She has said she's going to be independent. It'll be interesting to see how independent she'll be.
Yeah, exactly. To James in Wolf Lake, Michigan. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm not dissenting from the general hosannas here, but I do think it's going a little overboard. Does anybody's memory run to a time when a confirmation hearing wasn't used to take a poke at the president's policies on either side? Did anyone in the course when she was nominated suggest that they were opposed to her unalterably and that this was going to be a, quote, a tough confirmation process? And then third of all, in all of that connection, beyond her credentials such as they are, where do we see any indication in her testimony that she would actually confront the president if she needed to, beyond her assurances that, of course, she would?
Robert Rabin.
It's an excellent point. Thank you for making that. Yes, regrettably, Senator Vitter organized a petition to oppose Loretta Lynch long before the hearing. There are speculation that he's running for the governor of Louisiana and that he has motives other than that which inure to his position on the Senate Judiciary Committee. But people have stated their opposition to what they think she is prior to hearing from her. And the evidence that she'll be independent is that she is independent, that she's run the complicated U.S. Attorney's Office in the Eastern District of Brooklyn and gone after cops and robbers and Citigroup, Countrywide, HSBC. There's this notion in the United States that the Obama administration didn't go after banks and that they were too big to fail and that nobody went after people involved in Dodd-Frank. Well, she had four indictments against Citigroup, Countrywide, HSBC, and Morgan Stanley. It didn't come up in yesterday's hearing, but she's a pretty tough lady.
But that's not the independence, I think, Robert, that's being concerned here. It's whether when executive power, the president's own power, is at issue, she would resign like an Elliot Richardson. And remember, I was there, I'm that old,
Bruce,
when Richardson's hearings required extraction
we'll talk
of
after
promises.
The break, but it's sort of bizarre that the hallmark of an AG is whether or not she'll resign.
All right, we've got to take a short break here. When we come back, more of your calls, your comments. I look forward to hearing from you.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, providing online access to ratings and reviews of local companies to help consumers achieve their home improvement goals, whether that be a remodeled kitchen, a freshly painted house, or a new backyard. Learn more at angieslist.com. And from PBS with Earth, A New Wild, a new five-part series that takes a look at humanity's relationship with wild places on Earth and explores the future of nature. Earth, A New Wild premieres Wednesday at 9, 8 Central on PBS.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, 10 states now have animal welfare laws requiring bigger cages for hens and livestock. What these new rules could mean for food prices, farmers, and how we raise animals in the U.S. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And welcome back. You can join us if you like. 800-433-8850. Here is an email from Paul who says, I'd like your guest to comment on why Attorney General Holder has been so vilified by members of Congress. I voted in and observed every administration since President Nixon. I believe Eric Holder's been the best AG in 40 years, going after corruption and injustice in a fair and balanced way. Jeff Mason.
Well, I think different people from different sides will have different views on this, but I would start by saying I think his critics believe he's overtly political and that his dedication has been more to politics and some of his beliefs that probably in many ways correspond with the president and the White House than following or pushing for others' view of the law. So that's one place to start.
Well, I think another place is he was fiercely resistant to congressional oversight. That's what occasioned the vote virtually unprecedented in contempt of the Congress. It got litigated, and It was held that the Congress did have a right to various and sundry pieces of information. The Attorney General was, I think, quite almost disdainful of congressional authority to obtain various memoranda about which he, not the President, claimed executive privilege concerning Fast and Furious investigation of ATF and gun running into Mexico. And Congress has its amor propre, and he treated them with somewhat of a vassalage mentality, and that outrages them.
Well, he wasn't the first Attorney General held in contempt. Janet Reno was the first Attorney General held in contempt, and I think it's fascinating that in 230 years, the only two that have been held in contempt were the first woman and the first African-American. You do the math on that one. But I think the more interesting and important piece is that he's been effective and aggressive on stuff that drives conservatives, I won't use the word insane, but to the mat, the refusal to enforce the Defense of Marriage Act, which, you know, banning gay marriage was a rallying cry for conservatives, and President Bush ran his reelection campaign on that issue with constitutional amendments in the states and the federal government, and here Obama and Holder come along and say it's unconstitutional. I think that was an enormous problem for many conservatives, and I think his aggressive enforcement to try to restore voting rights after the conservative Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act, and he said, well, we're going to find another method to do it. So you could go on and find policy differences that are very, very important to conservatives, and I think that there's legitimate disagreement on policy, and that's a big piece of it.
All right, Anthony, here's another email from Kurt in Byron, Illinois. Says, if Republicans hate Holder so much, what do they have to say about Holder's predecessor, their guy that wrote the legal justifications for torture programs? Dale?
On which side? But how the Republicans feel?
Yeah.
I think, obviously the Republicans were supportive of the three attorney generals under the Bush administration. We started with John Ashcroft, then we had Al Gonzalez, and then we had Michael Mukasey, who was a federal judge. But I don't remember how the votes broke down, but they all passed in their confirmation hearings. And I believe the Republicans just were, you know, they towed the line of the Bush administration back then. I think they generally believed what they said. And even during this torture report, remember, that came out and that was the Democratic report, and they had to rush it out to get it published before the Republicans took over, because there's a stark disagreement about, you know, these national security matters between the Republicans and the Democratic side.
Exactly.
Yes.
What constitutes torture.
Yes. And many, many other national security matters.
Yes. All right. And Kurt goes on to ask, what does the nominee say about not prosecuting anybody from Wall Street? Robert Rabin.
Well, she has prosecuted people from Wall Street. I read the list, and I'm happy to do it again. She indicted Citigroup, Countrywide, HSBC, and Morgan Stanley, all of whom have outposts on Wall Street. So, I think the record trumps the speculation that she's not hesitant to indict those that she thinks have been guilty of wrongdoing. She told me and she told the nation she follows the facts. She applies it to the law. She makes a judgment, and she takes the consequences of that choice.
Intelligence Committee report cited the cases of waterboarding hundreds of times. She testifies waterboarding is torture. Let's see if she initiates investigations of those who Senator Mark Udall said are working for the government now who are implicated in these acts of waterboarding. That would be the true test. It wasn't done by Holder, who did nothing on this score.
That would be a test. That's right. First, she'd have to be confirmed, so please call upon your Republican colleagues to vote yes.
Yeah, I will.
What about her difference from the president on the issue of legalizing marijuana?
Well, she was pretty firm yesterday saying that she was against the legalization of marijuana, and I imagine that is from her experience being a federal prosecutor. I mean, they prosecute lots and lots of drug cases, but she also, if I remember her testimony correctly, focused on, I don't think she disagreed with how Holder and Cole, the deputy attorney general, have kind of tried to focus on marijuana, especially as states are legalizing it. Cole put out a memo, I believe, last year or the year before, that talked about Let's focus on high-level cases, you know, interstate traffic and the money laundering associated with the cartels doing this stuff. But we're going to leave, like, the low-level stuff to other people to prosecute. We're not going to deal with that. She kind of supported that during the hearing.
Bruce, I'd be interested in what you would enumerate as some of the major issues Republicans have and constitutional lawyers have with Eric Holder.
Well, I can't say that these are the ones that I think constitutional lawyers have. Some of the Republicans supported the same positions when it was done by Alberto Gonzalez and John Ashcroft, that they suddenly changed their mind on when it comes to Eric Holder. It's unfortunate, a phenomenon in Congress, that the Constitution changes based upon political affiliation. But the major issues they have with regard to, one, the war authority, you know, saying he can go to war against Libya or any other country based upon regional stability or any other national security interest the president identifies. Second, a major one was the memo saying that the president has authority to kill any American citizen based on his say-so alone, that they're in imminent danger. There can be no second-guessing by Congress or the courts, a power that has been utilized to kill at least four American citizens and maybe others. The authority that the president claims unilaterally outside of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act to spy on Americans to gather foreign intelligence. This is under Executive Order 12333. Then this is the use of executive agreements to station American troops abroad, most recently in Afghanistan, without the ordinary treaty that's required when we have troops that are committed to defend another country. So, those would be major issues, I think, Diane.
Okay. And what do you think Eric Holder should have done?
He should have approached the president and said, Mr. President, my oath is to support the Constitution of the United States, not you. You know, this is not Germany. You know, that this process is what's important here. You know, if you insist on going to war without congressional authorization, I am resigning, the same way that Elliot Richardson resigned, the same way that Francis Biddle should have resigned with concentration camps, by repeating, my oath, Mr. President, is the Constitution, not you.
All right.
You flout it, I'm gone.
All right, well, let's just remember that Holder and Obama are very tight. And Holder came out, I believe, in 2010 and said, we're going to prosecute Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in New York City. That's what we're going to do. He laid it out at a big press conference, but they didn't lay the groundwork with the people in New York. Everyone went crazy. The White House backed out, pulled the rug out from under him. And Holder didn't quit. You know, he towed the line. He didn't complain. He didn't go out and be like, oh, the president's making the wrong decision here. You know, I think that now, within Justice Department circles and within, you know, people who, federal prosecutors, they believe they probably should have prosecuted him in the United States because he would have been convicted already and, you know, gone
to
prison.
That's right. He's been vindicated. There have been convictions in Article III courts of terrorism prosecutions.
But the point is that he didn't complain. You know, he ate it. That's what he viewed his job as.
That's what Elliot Richardson could have just fired Archibald Cox and said, all right, we're shutting down the special prosecutor program. The country would be far more impoverished constitutionally if he did that.
There's a big difference between what Richard Nixon did with Watergate and, you know, those issues and crimes committed allegedly by people in the Oval Office.
This is when you're killing American citizens on your say-so alone, the teenager, Mr. Alaki's son, that is at least arguably a crime, which has been blocked.
So arguably a crime is not a crime.
I think it's also important to note that the president is also a constitutional lawyer.
All right. And let's go to Solomon in Indianapolis, Indiana. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I watched the process yesterday through C-SPAN, a retape of it, and I wish your guests, honorable guests, to comment on the question as it was presented to her by the Arizona senator. The question was specifically, are you Eric Holder? In my opinion, this was a very grandizing, intimidating question. With any one of them, without going too much into interpreting and slicing and dicing the question itself, would they defend that question other than what it is as face value?
Jeff Mason.
I don't think Loretta Lynch was particularly intimidated by that question. I think that, as we discussed at the very beginning of the show, that was a big theme hanging over the entire hearing, and she was ready for that. She absolutely knew that that was going to be part of what she would be asked, and she had a solid answer. She said, no, I won't be. If I'm confirmed, I'll be Loretta Lynch. There's really not a stronger answer than that.
When Eric Holder walked into a staff meeting this morning, he sat down and said, hello, everyone. I am indeed Eric Holder.
And
actually, he did do that.
At the White House, the deputy spokesman, Eric Schultz, took his first turn at the podium yesterday, and he was asked for a reaction about Loretta Lynch's testimony, and particularly that line about not being Eric Holder. And he was stumped for just a second and then said, well, it could be that she was just being literal. She's physically not Eric Holder.
But you know, I have to agree with our caller. It's a pretty insulting question.
Robert Rabin, how
do you prepare someone to take that kind of grief, if you will?
Well, there's two pieces to it. The absurdity of having a confirmation hearing, which is a constitutionally mandated and supposed to be a majestic process where the Senate does advice and consent on this crucial position, and 75% to 80% of the energy is about your predecessor. It's sort of insulting, I think, more to the Senate than to her, that we've reached a point of coarseness in our politics where this is okay and this is appropriate. Two things. You know, this is not a Democrat or Republican thing. This is our politics have become more coarse. Mukasey, who was the attorney general who followed Alberto Gonzalez, had a similar process. He enormously benefited from the fact that he was not Alberto Gonzalez. So it's a tough day for Eric Holder, and it's grossly unfair. It is not new to him. He has been attacked and humiliated over and over by people who oppose policy. But my heart goes out to him. He's an excellent attorney general. He's done some wonderful things. And I think there needs to be some rehabilitation of that.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Robert Rabin, I want to go back to my question. How do you prepare someone to take that kind of grief in public?
Well, if you have the confidence and trust of the person that you're working with, then you go for the really hard stuff, and you talk through how bad it can get, how personal it can get. I have had the honor of helping probably 50 to 75 nominees over the years, and everybody's different. What Ms. Lynch brought to it was a raw talent and experience, having stood up in federal court over and over again, having had press conferences. So my prep was infinitesimally small. It was really a series of conversations with her about what might happen, how it might go.
And were there any rough spots that she had to get through?
So you and your guests have been speaking about it. It's a humiliating and insulting question. How are you not Eric Holder? And you can say, well, I love kickboxing and he loves basketball. I'm 5 feet tall and he's not. I'm left-handed and he's not. And is that flip? Is that glib? How are people going to react to that? If the question is really, we don't like the intimacy that Attorney General Holder allegedly has with the president, and you're going to assure us you don't have that intimacy, where do you go with that? So she comported herself beautifully. She's a natural. She's had years and years of dealing with all kinds of things, including people mistreating each other in public.
So you say this is really nothing new. It's simply perhaps a little more public and a little more high level.
Yes, she's been to Rwanda and dealt with victims of genocide and amputees and grieving families. I think As awful as it is, I think 6 or 7 hours in front of a lot of men and a couple of women, who some of whom are scoring political points around her but don't really care about her, isn't the hardest thing she's ever done in her life.
That's the last question for you, Jeff Mason. Is this whole thing political theater? because she is going to be confirmed at the end.
It's always political theater, yes. And I think this show that we've talked a lot about, the aspects of the political theater, it's also, I mean, in fairness, it's the Republicans' chance to take advantage of the fact that they are in charge. And they did, and some of that may backfire, as we discussed. But in the end, she is likely to be confirmed. She needs at least two Republican votes to get out of this committee. And based on the comments that we heard, it seems pretty likely that's going to happen, and that she'll get full confirmation from the Senate.
Do you agree with that, Dale?
Yes, I agree with everything he said. I think that... it's political theater. The Republicans wanted to send a message to their voters, too. Like, we care about these issues, and this was their chance.
And Robert Rabin,
I don't think it's all political theater. I think, and I have deep respect for the legitimate oversight function of the committees of jurisdiction. And I think you saw a lot of that, and you saw some very well-meaning people asking just the right questions. I do think she'll be confirmed.
Bruce Fine, will she be confirmed, yes or no?
Yes, she will.
All right. Thank you all. Bruce Fine, Robert Rabin, Del Quinton Wilbur, Jeff Mason, and thanks, everybody, for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinker, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Natalie Yorblifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington, D.C. This is NPR.